Many people are concerned about the proliferation of plastic in our lives and do what we can to minimize our use of plastic and try to recycle it. Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Sawa Khan. Meanwhile, the oil, gas, and petrochemical industries have been and are working to increase the production of plastic. Plastic production has been going up every year. Beth Gardner is an award-winning environmental journalist whose latest book is Plastic Inc., The Secret History and Shocking Future of Big Oil's Biggest Bet. I asked Gardner why she wrote the book.
I've always been one of those people who carries around my reusable bag to the grocery store. I carry around my, my water bottle with me. I hate it if I forget the bags and I have to use, disposable bags from the store. I'm kicking myself if I'm out for a walk and I'm thirsty and, I don't want to buy a bottle of water because I've forgotten mine. So that's sort of the background. And then one day, 7 or 8 years ago, I think it is now, I saw this article. It was in The Guardian, and it felt like kind of a gut punch, I think, in retrospect and in the moment, because this article said that, while I and so many people out in the world like me were so distressed by the proliferation of plastic in our lives, that the biggest oil companies in the world, the Exxons and the Shells, and these huge very profitable players were actually ramping up to make more plastic than ever. The article was specific to US production, and the headline was that they were planning to increase their output of plastic by something like 40% in the coming years, and they were pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into the manufacturing facilities that they needed to do that. So it just came as such a shock, this idea that, I, and obviously I'm one of millions and millions of people who feel and behave this way, was so upset about the plastic everywhere around me in my life. And the images, those viral photos and videos we've all seen of sort of beaches carpeted with plastic and turtles with a straw up their nose, right? This is something people really care about. And I know so many people who are trying to use less plastic in their own lives. So the idea that we were sort of up against this kind of invisible, in the sense that I was not even aware as an environmental journalist that this was happening, push in the other direction, for so many of us, we view this issue through this lens of kind of personal responsibility, individual action, what can I do to use less plastic in my own life, which is great. And I don't cast aspersions on that at all. And I still do it. But, what I tried to do with this book is to shift the lens to more of a corporate and political accountability, because I think that's really where we need to look for the roots of this problem.
In the book, you provide a fascinating history about the development of plastic-type materials, starting with celluloid. Give us a little bit of that history.
Sure. So the modern era of plastics really started in the very late 1930s and through and after World War II. But if you go back to even the 1860s, that's when the earliest plastics were being developed. An interesting difference between those two eras is that in the earliest days, there was really new materials were being developed and researched as a way to respond to sort of really specific needs in the marketplace. So the earliest plastic, celluloid, which we know from sort of film still and moving pictures, were filmed on celluloid, but it was used for all kinds of everyday products, including dentures, funnily enough, was really developed in response to a very specific need. And that was a contest that was sponsored by a billiard ball company. Billiards was a very popular game at the time. The balls were made from ivory, from the tusks of elephants, and you actually needed ivory was used widely in, the handles of hairbrushes and mirrors, hand mirrors, piano keys, things like that. They needed a very, very specific and high grade type of ivory for billiard balls, and the elephant populations of the world were being decimated by this. A guy named John Wesley Hyatt, who was a printer in upstate New York, began playing around with all kinds of different materials. He was taking cellulose from cotton. So this was actually one of the plastics that was derived from natural materials rather than from fossil fuels, which is where we get most modern plastics. But it's an interesting example because, at the time, and it's sort of a painful irony as we look back, plastics were seen, and John Wesley Hyatt's company promoted them this way as sort of a way to break the link between humanity's need and desire for sort of modern manufactured goods and the natural world. Up until then, if you wanted to make something, you had to look to the earth for your raw materials, whether that was, trees for wood or paper, whether it was, shellac from the secretions of the Southeast Asian lac beetle, whether it was silk from silkworms, and those materials had a limited supply, and it had an impact on, the earth to on the environment to sort of be harvesting them in ever-growing quantities. So plastics at the beginning looked like a way to sort of spare some of those resources, whether it was the tusks of elephants or the trees of our forests. Obviously, it's turned out differently today, but that was kind of the beginning. And what began to change in the more modern era of plastics leading up to and after World War II was that kind of the relationship between supply and demand began to be turned on its head. So, as I said in the beginning, the earliest plastics in the mid and late 1800s were about filling a really specific need. And later on, they became a way of making use of sort of byproducts of oil and gas that would have otherwise gone to waste and could be monetized if they could be turned into something else, which ended up being plastic. And that dynamic of this inversion of supply and demand, I think, is very unique to and characteristic of plastic and its role in our world even today. And it begins with the roots of this material in oil and gas.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, here today with Beth Gardner, award-winning journalist and author of Plastic Ink. In the 1940s through the 60s, there was sort of an avalanche of new plastic products. Is that right?
In the late 1930s and into World War II, we saw the development of a whole host of new plastics, including, really importantly, polyethylene and nylon. These resulted from, experimentation that scientists across the world were doing with these byproducts of oil and gas that didn't really have much of a use, but they had a lot of interesting chemical properties. And during the war, polyethylene and nylon in particular turned out to be incredibly useful. Nylon was used for parachutes and all kinds of other military equipment. Polyethylene, which is today the world's most widely used plastic, had its first and one of its most essential uses in lightweighting radar sets so that Allied pilots could carry radar on their planes. And it increased their effectiveness tremendously. After the war, it became clear that with those sort of military markets no longer there, became clear to the industry, which was the oil and petrochemical companies producing all this plastic, that they would need to find new markets. Very quickly, sort of consumer products companies, manufacturers of everything from toys to telephones and typewriters, began buying up some of these materials, these plastics that were suddenly flooding onto the market as the producers ramped up their volume. And as they looked around for, how to sell them and how to get them into stores and into people's homes, one thing that became clear was that packaging would be a really good way to do that. So this was a time, you have to remember, when people had really grown up through the Depression and the war on an ethos of sort of reusing, make do and mend. You fix something, you use it again, you don't throw it out. So there was a line from a writer I read who was covering some of these issues that said consumers had to be taught how to waste. We had to be trained to not, bring the Coke bottle back to the store so that it could be carted back to the bottling plant and refilled again, but instead to throw the bottle in the trash. And it's interesting now because that disposability is such a just sort of fundamental part of our modern world. I think we don't really question how it came about, but disposability was really very intentionally invented and sort of promulgated by huge companies, whether they were, the Coca-Colas of the world, which had built an enormous and extremely sophisticated system of reuse where bottles would be shipped back to the bottling facility and refilled dozens and dozens, sometimes up to 100 times per bottle. There was a fellow in the plastics industry who gave a speech at an industry conference in, I think it was the 1960s in New York, who explained that that was a sort of lost opportunity for profit, not only for Coke, but for plastics and packaging companies. If one bottle is reused 90 or 100 times, well, then gosh, you could actually replace it with 90 or 100 bottles and sell them to the drink company and then on to the consumer who would pay the price. So this idea of disposability was really very lucrative to a lot of industries, from the oil and gas producers on to the petrochemical companies, excuse me, that made the plastic, and the companies that were using it to package their goods, whether it was food and drink or all the packaged items we're used to seeing in the stores today. It was an opportunity for them to increase their profits. So this model of disposability is often sort of described today as like, oh, well, we sort of quotes, we the consumers are lazy and we want convenience and we just want throw away everything. But we never really demanded that. This was a model that was pushed on us. And in fact, there was some testimony at the time from the head of a major Coke division who spoke to Congress and said that consumers were actually pretty happy with reusable bottles. They were not demanding throwaways at all, but it was pushed on us and then we were blamed for it.
Something I found shocking in the book is how marketing and advertising was used to make consumption of products a way of life for Americans.
Actually, one of the sort of founders of modern marketing was a nephew of Sigmund Freud. And he kind of weaponized a lot of his uncle's insights about the human psyche to understand that it's not just the need for a product that makes you pull out your wallet in the store, right? It could be anything from sort of envy and insecurity to fear and kind of a desire for safety. So advertisers, first actually began targeting the manufacturers. The plastics industry saw that if they could convince the makers of, goods for the home to shift their material from, aluminum or metal or cardboard or whatever they had used before into plastic, that would be a way to get more of their material into the markets, but that they aimed at the consumers too. There were huge, spreads in major national magazines like Good Housekeeping, kind of describing how plastics would bring a new era of convenience and it would save the women of America, the housewives of America, from so much work if they could, kind of buy packaged foods, convenience foods in the grocery store instead of slaving for hours over the stove. So it was a real concerted push, and there were, this was the time, the 1950s and 60s. It's Mad Men, right? Advertising grew into an enormous industry, and it was aimed at sort of turning America into a country of consumers, where kind of buying things would be central to people's lives.
At some point, the big oil companies knew that the burning of fossil fuels, including oil and gas, were damaging the Earth's environment. What did they do about it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think as we know from some of the incredible reporting that has been done in recent years by first by journalists from Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times under the heading of Exxon New, they some of these companies, including but not limited to Exxon, did some of the earliest and most sophisticated climate research that's been done, or it's certainly that was available at the time. As far back as the 1960s and 70s, some of their predictions are coming true today with, you know, actually really astonishing accuracy in terms of temperature rises and sea level rises and all of the impacts we know that that's having, the wildfires and the storms and the droughts and the heat. They did not warn the world. They buried the science. They trashed any independent scientists who tried to you know, sound the alarm. And in the meantime, they began pouring money into, you know, securing their own infrastructure, right? There's some shocking reporting in these Exxon News stories about how they spent money to elevate their, you know, coastal sort of drilling and protect their own, infrastructure, their oil and gas drilling equipment and roads and all of that. From the climate impacts that they knew would come while they were telling the rest of us that you know it wasn't true. And in fact there's as you know, a tremendous amount of litigation today focused on exactly that they knew and they lied to us and they tried to cover it up. And one thing that I learned with in reporting this book, which is absolutely fascinating, is that they also began looking for new markets for plastic because you know, particularly today as the realities of climate change have become ever more undeniable, although obviously there are still many people who deny them. The oil and gas industry can, in fact, see that demand for oil and gas as fuels in the coming years is really threatened and pretty likely to plateau and eventually decline as electric vehicles become more and more common and clean energy is now undercutting, as we know. Fossil fuels as a source of electricity as well. So these companies, the Exxons and the Saudi Aramcos of the world, can see that you know their markets are threatened in the future, and if they can put more and more of their production, the oil and gas they take out of the ground, into making plastic rather than selling them as you know gas to put in your car, then that's a way for them to continue drilling. Perpetuate this unbelievably destructive business model that they've created and that we don't really need anymore. If they can sell us more plastic, push more plastic into the market, that's a way for them to keep monetizing that oil and gas. So, you know, it's evolved over the years, but that's to me the sort of plastic strategy, these plastic dreams that the industry is so wrapped up with now is very much rooted in these decades of climate denial and delay that we've seen as far back as the 60s and 70s.
I was surprised to read in your book that sneakers are almost entirely plastic. Talk about the many plastics we encounter every day.
It's a word we often use in the singular, right? Like this cup is made from plastic. But in fact, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of plastics. And there are sort of like big families of plastic, almost like polyethylene is often referred to as a type of plastic. But there are, you know, an unfathomable, I don't even know the number. There's a, you know, tremendous number of different kinds. Same thing for polyurethane. These are very common plastics, but they come in just innumerable iterations, right? Because the chemical recipe can just kind of be adjusted and tweaked. They put in additional chemicals that are called additives to change the properties. It's hard, it's soft, it's dense, it's floppy, it's foamed, it's you know, solidified. It's all kinds of different colors. It's got a different kind of level of pliability. You know, I think one thing that is so sort of characteristic of plastic's role in our world is like thinking about this when I wrote the book. If I look, or if you look at a, you know, a table, for example, or a piece of paper, we kind of know intuitively on some level that started out as a tree. But if you look at, you know, I'm holding a pair of plastic reading glasses in my phone, in my hand right now, or my phone, or a pair of sneakers, as you say. I don't think we have that intuitive sense of kind of what that is. What did it actually start as? And that's sort of a tip off, I guess. If you can't answer that question, I would say there's a pretty good chance it's plastic. I think when we have this conversation about kind of plastic pollution, plastic waste, it tends to focus on the obvious items, right? The disposable utensils that you get in a with a takeout order, the packaging, the plastic wrap, plastic bags. But right, a pair of sneakers is made of, probably dozens of different kinds of plastic, nylons and foamed polyurethanes, every piece of it, from the sole to the laces to the uppers to the sort of padding under your foot, right? The same is true for sort of mattresses. There's a tremendous amount of synthetic textiles, in our rugs, our furniture, our curtains and drapes, and that are all based on whether it's nylons or polyethylenes, polyesters, different kinds of synthetic fibers. And we don't sort of think about this as directly, I think, when we think about kind of plastic and plastic waste, but these are all different iterations of plastics. They're all polymers, is the technical term, that are created from different byproducts of oil and gas, and turned through, tremendously complicated and energy intensive and polluting chemical processes into the materials that are all around us every day.
That's a great point that you don't think of oil and gas when you buy a polyester shirt.
And I mean, that was actually sort of shocked me when I started thinking about this, because I'm an environmental journalist. I've been writing about these kinds of issues for, probably 15 years. And I realized, like, I don't exactly know what plastic is. I mean, I kind of know generally, and knew before I started working on this book. Now I know in a little more detail. But I knew that these plastics came from oil and gas in some way, but I didn't kind of know much more than that. I think that's by design. The petrochemical industry, the oil companies that are making these things, they're not consumer-facing companies, right? We buy the plastic bottle from, Coke, Pepsi, whatever. We don't buy it from Exxon or INEOS or SABIC or Saudi Aramco, these huge petrochemical companies. And they're sort of hidden in plain sight in a way. And I think the link between oil and gas and plastics is, in a sense, is hidden that way too. We just don't think about it.
All this plastic is coming from chemical plants, and these are located along the Gulf Coast of Texas and Louisiana, but also north in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. These plants are spewing out a lot of pollutants. What does this mean for just the environment in general, but specifically for the people that live near these plants?
Well, it's pretty awful. And the fossil fuel and petrochemical industry, from many years of experience, is pretty savvy about locating its production in states that are pretty light touch, shall we say, regulators. The industry is very, very powerful in those states. Obviously, they need to locate where the resources are coming. Where the resources are being drilled. So that's, as you said, in the United States, it's along the Gulf Coast, mostly Texas and Louisiana, big oil and gas states. And what we've seen in recent years in the US with the growth of fracking is that a lot of byproducts of fracking are usable in, as ingredients for making plastics. So that's why Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, West Virginia, fracking country, has also now become, to some degree, a plastic production country. There's a big Shell plastic production facility not far outside of Pittsburgh that opened a few years ago, and it turns ethane, which comes from fracking wells across Western Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia, into plastic. And it's devastating for the people who live nearby. I met people down in Louisiana living alongside plastic production facilities, the levels of toxic carcinogenic chemicals in their air are through the roof, and so are levels of all kinds of illness and death rates in the neighborhoods nearby. And they tend to be these facilities disproportionately located in communities of color and economically disadvantaged communities. You know, those are typically the places that are less sort of politically powerful. They're where the plants are located, and they're where the suffering takes place.
In the 1980s, the concept of recycling plastic starts to take hold. What was the plastic industry's response?
They understood very early on that recycling didn't actually really have that much to offer when it came to plastic. For plastic, a very small number of plastics, and in a sort of least worst way, recycling can be helpful for sort of mitigating the problem. But the technical and economic challenges to doing it are enormous. But the public relations benefits of talking it up are even bigger. I think the industry understood that very quickly. The writer Susan Frankel, in her book a number of years ago, quoted an industry executive and lobbyist using the term guilt eraser, that plastic was a guilt eraser. Consumers were worried. They felt bad every time they threw something plastic in the trash because it, you know, they could just picture it sort of sitting in a landfill. And recycling, people loved it. The public wanted to recycle, and the industry saw that. So they started pouring their advertising dollars into promoting this idea of recycling, engaging us in the belief that all this plastic we were throwing in our recycling bins could be recycled. It's really not the case. It's extremely difficult to do. People throw everything plastic in the recycling bin, and all these different kinds of plastics. They're different chemical substances, even if they sometimes look the same. It's overwhelming for the sort of sorters, the recycling facilities that are trying to deal with this stuff.
What can people do?
Well, you know, write to your representative, write to your state government, your local government. One thing that we've really seen is that when even, you know, sort of a local municipality or county starts considering, you know, even a pretty just targeted ban on individual plastics, the industry throws everything at trying to defeat those bans. And it tells you that they're meaningful. So you can, you know, get involved with asking your town or city council to consider a law like that. Those kinds of actions, I think, are meaningful.
That's all for now. Thanks to Beth Gardner and her book, Plastic Ink, and thanks so much to you for listening. Our website is mothering-earth.com. Until next time, this is Salwa Khan signing off for Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. The views and opinions expressed on Mothering Earth do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of this station.